said, he's been a product to myself up to this time. We had a quarter of a cup of FDA, 50 years removed from the drug of the Soviet Union. And I made all this because I had my own experience in the room together. And I had two presenters that had been going to the FDA teams. So, Fresco from the Baltimore and Joe Wilson of the Tax Foundation were going. And I continue the practice of allowing people to ask questions during the presentation. You know, many people get to the end of each individual slide in order to hear questions that will be helpful. Our community, they provide our office to the link that allows them to get crisis people or our representative story. Talking about home rules, and if you're forcing an exercise, brought your own personal disability, and then you can let out as you go through that presentation. And then I looked at it in
yes, cool. Uh-oh. Oh, my God. Can
we are not getting an echo, but you are cutting in and down a little bit.
Same thing. I don't know what to do with that. Any suggestions? I never used Teams before. But let's get going. We'll find out.
Right, thanks back to us, and I just want to recognize also that we're representative of cases in the minutes. Uh-oh. And have
you can write me guys at the table if you'd like.
All right, this last
one is going. Okay, I think we'll get it going and see what happens. Thank you. I apologize for my technical challenges. I also have a construction site going on around my office here. And hopefully I won't be too late. What I'm going to talk to you about, and thank you for the invitation to join you, is a project called Commonwealth North that was created by our fiscal policy study group. And Commonwealth North is an organization that was founded in 1979 by Governors Egan and Hickel, and they wanted to bring Alaskans together in a nonpartisan way to talk about issues important to Alaska's future. And we do our work through study groups. And the project that I'm going to talk to you about is a result of the work of our fiscal policy study group. And over the years, we've talked with many of you as part of our deliberations and our research into issues that the legislature faces. So the budget places website went up in September, and resulted in an effort to engage Alaskans in talking about the choices and trade-offs involved in balancing the budget. And candidly, it would have been a lot easier if we had done an Excel spreadsheet. But we thought that missed the whole point of the winners and the losers that are involved each time you as a legislator make a budget decision. And we wanted to come up with a tool that helped engage Alaskans in thinking about, well, gosh, if I decrease spending, who's impacted by that? But if I increase spending, how am I going to pay for it? And so we wanted a way in which to help them experience those kinds of choices and trade-offs involved, where somebody wins and somebody loses each time a budget decision is made. And so what we're bringing to you today is the results. Since September, we've had over 2,000 Alaskans participate in the survey, the choices, work through them. And so I'm going to highlight some of the important tools and then also summarize some of the other responses that we received. So, Rose, you want to advance to the next slide? Okay. So this is just a summary page. We did briefly on the budget choices website, we had a video that if you haven't had a chance to watch it, it was intended to help summarize the current circumstance that the state found itself in last summer. Again, we've been working on this last summer and deploying it in the fall. So while the numbers have changed and could be updated, the fact is it's still a heck of a lot of a challenge to try and fill a $1.3 billion deficit, whether it's $1.9 billion or $1.1 billion. So next slide. So in terms of where we got responses from, this gives you an idea geographically where they came in from. Interestingly is that in areas, but perhaps potential weaknesses of scientifically systematic sample analysis population. It was also that kind of people participating. But I know that you all would be interested in, well, who are these people? Where are they from? By the way, we don't know who these people are. The only identifier that we asked for and required was their zip code. And that was so that we could then get into these geographic areas. So NOS means better identifying information was not required. Okay, so what did we say? Next slide. So in terms of the spending choices, there were 18 different spending areas that we asked about. Basically, for the most part, Alaskans need to maintain current funding in these areas, early learning, Medicaid, social benefits, senior benefits, pioneer homes, et cetera, you can read the slide. So basically, we asked you on the increase or decrease of maintain current spending, we gave percentages, but for the most part in these areas, people said, yes, keep what we have. In terms of what are we just spending, they did say the governor's office and the legislature. Go figure. Okay, so that's sort of a brief summary of some of the spending choices. A little bit more, which was interesting in K through 12, certainly, you know, one of the biggest programs with unrestricted general funds. And you can see here that, well, 31% said to maintain current funding, 35% said to increase it. And we gave choices either a 2% increase or a 5% increase. And that 35% said to decrease funding, and we gave a choice of decreasing funding 5% or 1%. So you can see that pretty much is a third in terms of how to address K-12 funding. In terms of the university, 39% just said to proceed with the planned $20 million cut. 35% said to reinstate some of the cuts. We gave them a choice of reinstating the cuts planned for this year, or taken this year, as well as reinstate all the prior cuts, or maintain the current funding, and 25% said to maintain the current funding. Transportation, this was one where it was pretty close between two of the options. 31% said to transition a ferry to a self-sustaining model, and 29% said to maintain the current funding. And there was a couple of other choices related to highway funding, but that was the choice. So in terms of the high profile, can we move to the next slide?
Representative's part of the question.
Oh, okay. Yes, ma'am.
I have some thinking chairs, Bob Wilson, two chairs, Brasco. Thank you very much for representing today and for making a comment on your report and information. I was just maybe wondering when I was looking at the K-12 funding, I was not looking at comment, but when it says to maintain current funding at 31%, I wonder if people who check that box understand that if, I guess when I look at 35% of the increase, if we just maintain current funding, there will be changes to class size, to services, because we do have increased costs that go up every year. So when I look at this, I'm wondering what residents are thinking when I say maintain current funding. Are they thinking, well, to do that, you have to increase funding? Or do they realize that we're losing services if we just maintain the current amount? I guess is a better way to say that.
Sure. We did have on the website, I don't know if you've got a chance to look at it, there was merits of depreciating each of these choices to help them think about, you know, on one hand and on the other hand. We did not have a statement that said, you know, to cover current costs, to continue with current costs, you have to get more money. Some might say that we have a few students in schools. And so I think you better, people, we didn't say it, but they probably understand from the personal budget that as utility costs go up, gasoline prices go up, if my income stays the same, I have to spread it. So that's a long answer saying, no, we didn't tell them that, but some of them made it to time into that. And again, we consider these ways of spending choices. And the way we structure each of these choices on the options, I've reiterated them again here. And so the four choices on the dividend were they could follow the statutory formula, which we explained that would cost an additional $1.2 billion. And again, our premise was if you were going to continue the same level of services this year, what's the difference between the projected revenues for next year? And so that's where we based a lot of these numbers. So if you're going to pay the last 3 years of dividends, that would be a cost of $2.2 billion in terms of balancing the budget. If you're going to pay out the same amount next year as this year, there was no change in terms of our budget calculator. And then if you were to suspend dividends for now, it would say this takes $689 next year. So what did Alaska say about that? So the next slide, please. So what you see here is, again, on the far left is what all the responses added up to, and then regionally what the responses were. So starting on the left, the darker blue line, that was used as statutory formula. So you see here that 12% of the respondents said to use that formula to pay the dividend. 12% in the orange bar said to pay the last 3 years of the dividend. The gray bar is paying out the same amount as this year. 42% said that. And then 34% said it was okay to suspend payment of the dividend until the state can afford it. So then the same information is repeated in the other areas of the state that we were tracking.
Some form of
the same students. So 20% were willing to consider each, both a 1% and a 2% sound six. 11% were 4% sound six, and a 6% sound six, but the least one. 6% with a 6% sales tax. So again, gives you a sense of tolerance level by at least the 2008 Alaskans that participated in our survey. And then finally, in permanent bed earnings, we suggested a special action so you can get an additional amount of the earnings above what the current formula is. And so you see the three options we gave, or we can follow the existing payout formula. So on the last page of the PowerPoint, you can see where 58% said to follow the existing formula. And so that meant that there was the balance that were willing to take some additional. And you can see where 17% were okay with another 0.5%, et cetera. So, so gives them a visual flavor of what the thinking was. And all of this, when they went through the website, it was tallied up in a running poll. And so if you chose to spend more on education, then the deficit was more than the $1.3 billion, and as you offset your spending with revenues, so again, the whole goal was to get this, the choices you'd have to make in order to get it into balance. So that's the summary of the report. You each did get a copy of the report itself. We did have a correction on page 27 related to the narrative about permanent bed earnings being a double case about bill taxes. So we'll get that corrected in tomorrow so you have a corrected copy, but the date is okay. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any other questions you have. In our perfect world, this would have been the basis for community-based discussions as opposed to doing a virtual exercise. And so hopefully, unless you solve the problem in session, and we no longer have a need for this, but if you haven't solved the problem in session and some of these issues still are outstanding, then our hope is that we'll be able to use a similar tool updated to have some person-to-person discussions about these choices.
I took a look at the survey that's been well. In the end, the survey told you whether the budget was balanced. I don't recall whether you could leave the budget unbalanced. Do you remember? Could you tell me how that worked? Was the balance sheet required before you could stop participating in this?
No, you did not have to balance the budget, and you can submit your choices still. And again, this was intended to be an educational process for Alaskans as they make the struggle of trying to balance the budget. And hopefully when they couldn't get it balanced, but that was an education in itself, but this is not just an Excel spreadsheet, but instead, gosh, those choices are really hard, but I'm still going to submit my efforts. And so it's not scientific, but our goal was to have them also have an educational experience, which I think they did, even if they weren't able to balance it. And I did check about a month or two ago how many were balanced versus not balanced, and it was about 55% of the responses submitted did balance the budget. Statistical sample. And so it was a different tool. It's hard to imagine being able to go through all of this information about the choices and the trade-offs in a statistical sample. Unless we do that in a community-type discussion where you select a sample of people based on their demographics, you bring them together, you work through this information, it can be done that way.
Thank you. I still would back up your alarm about them being expensive. I just wanted to know if you could do that. Thank you.
That would be interesting.
Interested in the topic and say people
colleagues and maybe thinking about different things in their life, and I think that we see that as it relates to participation in the legislative process and in voting in other areas. So it doesn't surprise me that I don't see that as the participation is a little bit on the mature side.
Very useful and informative.
reports and things about fish landing taxes, etc. But what this does remind me of is how difficult any poll is, right? So, politicians, they write the narrative in their heads they want to write. This says that 28% of the people don't, respondents don't want an income tax. So what do I get from that? Or I say, well, geez, in my district, it's a 52%. Well, 52%, boy, that's not a very secure vote. because I don't want to capitalize 48%. At some point, the legislature is going to be forced to make policy decisions. And the blessing and curse of COVID, the curse is 150,000 people deceased. The blessing, thanks to our grandchildren, is that we're watching money. In a way that we can't quite figure out what to do with compliant with federal law. So, I appreciate the presentation very much, but unless the poll says 80%, the elected official is insecure, or 70% perhaps, or they don't quite believe what they're reading. But nonetheless, I'm not knocking the poll. As I said, I found it very useful during the lesson.
Exercise that Common Run Purpose created for us is a very useful tool for educating folks about our fiscal bill. And it's not easy to balance the banking, and I think as Travis said, but only 55% were balanced. And a lot of people didn't have needs and have choices that you can be made. And of course, those trade-offs were not a part of the banking tool. And we had to come up with a process that seemed practical to implement and achieve their ends. They were able to sort of talk, for example, about the liability of what we're spending the permanent funding and what that would mean to the state of Alaska. But in terms of the information with regard to public opposition or support for sales and for income taxing, this is not a representative sample of what we're suggesting that it is, but I think one of the things that for me as a member of Alaska was a little surprising is that so many people did in fact support in revenue and didn't propose massive budget cuts. That, I had grown up in, for most of my, most of my adult life, were very, very conservative state, where people felt like we needed to cut the budget. We have been cutting the budget now for years, and I think part of what I got out of seeing this later from this is that a lot of Alaskans understand that we've got the budget, and understand it very difficult to us, and we've got some unanimity about, what should be done necessarily. But I suppose it's great people supported sales or income taxes as so much better, and as few people advocated, aggressive cuts as the strategy for balancing the budget, because I think, if you were to just sort of listen to social media, you might think that, there were easy solutions, and clearly there's not, and I'm surprised to see so many people supporting it. Sometimes I think politicians just have to be, make the tough decisions that are in the best interest of their state. Anything in the public about this is part of, my objective is to run this committee, and that's part of the reason we wanted to have this hearing today. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you. Easy to just go, oh, no, it's
partnership there. Because politically, some of this stuff is easier and harder. You know, the dividends, you know, we could have had a new formula section. You know, if you want a new formula on these debt returns, I guess, and none of these things are in a vacuum. And as we talk about here, you know, we do have to balance the budget. So it needs to, if people participating actually had to finish with a balanced budget, because then their choices might have been a little different. Because we have to balance the budget, we'll be done with savings. And this is overdrawn, those days are pretty much over. So and the balance between revenue, services, and EFD, that's sort of this three-way dance that people have to navigate. And, you know, you have to explain to them through now, you know, the future of the PFD, the amount of the PFD, the future of income taxes, the amount of income taxes, or some other factor, other revenue sources, it's all sort of balanced together. And I guess my last takeaway that I also mentioned earlier is some of these numbers they're managing the income tax, and it's close to half the people are receiving taxes involved, which is, when you look at the one now, but then three half columns, various amounts is interesting. Also, the important part, the overall, the people in one idea are full PFD or back PFD, total is 24%. And that means 76% are okay with no PFD or $1,000 PFD. So I think that's the 80% of the percentage of society.
Investments and investing your actual capital fee revenue, and that's 3.3%.
diversify it into other ways to ensure that there's enough resources to cover basic expenses. Because of this realization of volatility, if not taking a coin, there are hedges. You have, of course, let's take a look at the next slide.
Itself. But there's just this fundamental
Well, my parent is telling me that not trying to get through the
Alaskans in the aggregate set 5.8%.
because this is much lower than the average state. In fact, the national average is over 20%. So you're more than 40, almost 50% lower than the national average. You have a handful of states that are sort of notably low tax, but you are still lower than, but much lower than the average state, as you can see. And that would be true even if you adopted an additional major tax. If you adopted both major taxes, that would no longer be true. You wouldn't be a high tax state. But if you were to adopt some version of a moderate rate income and sales tax, then you would be probably still in the lower half, but you'd be pretty low in the pack. If you were to adopt just one of the two, that's some of the rates that have been discussed, you would still be among the lowest tax base in terms of tax burden because you were significantly lower than most of your peers. And if the thought is that this hopefully will be
if you could pause at the end of each slide for you to have a chance to ask questions, we're going to start with that chart of all.
Thank you, Dr. Chairman. On this graph, the fall of 50 states, so I understand this tax burden includes local property tax, local sales tax, motor fuel tax, anything that anyone who lives in Alaska pays out. In aggregate, it's 5.8%. So that's inclusive of every possible tax, alcohol tax, cigarette tax, marijuana tax, whatever it is you have to pay. That's inclusive of that. Thank you. So is it fair to assume we just have another presentation to talk to questions about people who are going to get tax? Whatever, for example, is 4% flat income tax. So if I took my 5.8% or 4% flat income tax, I'm going to assume it's not going to go up to 9.8% because not everyone's going to pay the 4%. So it's going to go up some fraction of that 4%, something that you're probably better at calculating than I am. So if there was an income tax, only certain people would pay it and so on. Is that correct?
Yes, that is absolutely correct. I can only give very rough estimates of what that would mean right now. You can try to run something, but if you went 0.4% income tax, assuming there were, some of the normal exclusions and exemptions, making some really rough assumptions, instead of going 5.8%, 9.8%, we'd probably be closer to the low 7% range, but you have very, very rough estimates.
I'm looking at that 5.8% which you're picking up the tax burden on Alaskans. It seems that you're assuming in that 5.8% calculation that the energy resources are not actually owned by Alaska. Of course, they're held and valued here in Alaska. What would that 5.8% look like if you took into account that there's a lot of oil and energy resources that are in fact being taxed?
Well, Chair, we are looking at this in terms of what capital flows on it. So, yes, Alaskans own their oil. The taxes are largely going to be incurred by the investors who exploit those markets, because you have a global price on oil, your taxes are not meaningfully changing the price of oil, they are changing the cost of extraction. So, to your question, if you had lower severance taxes, I think you could argue that more oil in Alaska is in the U.S. because it has a lower price. Whether that is to the benefit of Alaskans is unclear, because as has been noted, you are generating excessive royalties on behalf of the people of Alaska. These taxes are in many ways for their benefit, and we can discuss the structure, we can discuss what's competitive, and there's all kinds of different ways to approach this, but I don't think that it would make sense to have a burden analysis that assumes that the taxes on oil and gas were burdening Alaskans as the ultimate owner of the resources. That would be on the number that would probably make very
So since Alaska is different in that respect of who owns the natural resources, is there any analysis that you have here that distinguishes that fact about Alaska from the 49 other states?
I think we do in our paper talk about the effects on Alaska for taxes, and we acknowledge that we distinctly in Alaska create the system that's important, and what it means, and what it also means in terms of the burning ground and some of the other funds available. But again, in terms of burdens, I don't believe that it makes sense to think of those taxes as burdening Alaskans. It's the burdens are largely building on the investment side. So, should you have to start Alaska, you know, like I got according to our investors are across the country and across the world. But it's not really economically that the burden of those oil and gas taxes would be directly falling on Alaska. I think the indirect effects, if you had, relatively high taxes on the oil and gas industry, you would have lower employment, you would have various effects. But in terms of the direct tax effect, this is one of the new takes of our analysis. This is how you would think of tax burdens.
I also look at oil taxes actually as a benefit to most Alaskan friends. Frankly, my education was paid for by oil taxes. I was public safety my whole life. There's Alaskans benefit a lot from oil taxes as well. Representative Charlie.
Yeah, thank you for the chair. Especially in part is the fact that the program that dividend in recent years has been reduced to go faster than the effective tax rate for Alaska is listed here on the chart.
It's a big question, and we keep on this. We use census data, and it is not considered a tax provision. It is outside of that. If you were to include the permanent fund dividend as essentially a dividend income tax, which you could conceptualize it as that, then the overall number would be lower, but by a significant number, and although it would have grown relative terms over the last few years as that's been reduced.
Thank you, Chair. I just made the same question, which was in your tax burden calculation. The fact that last year every family child got $1,000, which could be considered a negative tax because it's not money you give to the government, it's money the government gives to you. So, and I guess I'm curious if you calculated that $1,000 received, not paid out, and that 5.8% would go down, you said that to group level about how much. How much would it be to get to zero, I guess?
So, sure, I actually think that you may be pretty close to zero when you account for that. And I'm trying to write the number roughly before the hearing ends, but I do not have that in front of me.
So, here's what you're saying is whatever tax we're going to pay out for water bill and every little tax that we can get out, and we get money from this on the street.
We
could be in a net zero tax
point. No, Chair, I don't think you're at quite zero, but it's very, very low. I will try to get a better answer for you.
Would you like to talk about that from the committee as well, since you're going to do a presentation? Who's going to be the guy to do things you want to do all that? Very good. That sounded very interesting.
Thank you. Thank you for the presence of this slide. Let's go to the next. I'm hoping this will answer some of the questions that we've been interested in. We've been discussing some of the previous ones. This is looking at sources of revenue. I explained only in a state and local combined, and we do focus only on the state and local combined here because obviously, Alaska is different from that, and especially as a major source of the local funding as well. So, this is fiscal 2018 figures, unfortunately, because that's the only way we can do compilation where there's the most recent census data. So, I mentioned earlier, it's in fiscal 2021 data for Alaska. We just don't have that for every state. Bear that in mind, it's a limitation because things have changed overall, but Alaska is seeing more volatility than most. Nonetheless, you can see that at the state level, you have obviously no reliance on income or general sales taxes. You're very similar to the rest of the country on your excise and selective sales taxes. So that's going to be obviously it includes the revenue tax on the global number, but it includes all of the other excise taxes, whether it's tobacco or alcohol or anything like that. It's the right. So a lot of women in areas, but it's not obviously all the state. But the enormous difference, obviously, 55% of your revenue goes to the other category, is 9% nationwide, yes, in some respects. Again, property tax is way more significant, not because of residential property taxes or the traditional commercial rates, but more state oil and gas property that's driving that distinction. And then you are at 0% on the individual and general sales tax. That's not really at local. You can see that you are less than a third of what the average state relies on for state and local sales tax collections, because you have, I believe, 107 local sales tax jurisdictions. That number's a year old. It's possible it's changed a little bit. About 107 of those, but you obviously don't have a state level sales tax. Some of those local sales taxes are higher than most local sales taxes in the country. You know, you have a handful of states, Louisiana and Illinois will come to mind, that have very high rate local sales taxes. It's otherwise rare, but of course you have this in certain jurisdictions in Alaska because you don't also have a state levy. And that's one of the challenges, by the way, in imposing a state level sales tax, is that it would be on top of some unusually high rate local ones. And it's been the question of just what the total rate is. Even unless you're at a very low rate. But then the second part of this slide is the revenue per capita Alaska versus the national average. And I did want to draw your attention primarily to the state and local combined, because I hope that addresses some of the questions. You can see it here. For our revenue, it's $21,064 per capita in Alaska, and $14,209 nationally. And you can see the tax revenue isn't actually that different. You are lower on tax revenue per capita. Not that much lower. So, you mentioned the state and local combined, and you do have a very different structure. But revenue from other sources was 68% higher per capita, even though at the state level, even though the tax revenue is 40% lower than the national average, combined state and local is only 11% lower than the national average on tax revenue, and about 50% higher on our revenue. And that is largely deriving from the property taxes and some of the other local taxes that default on the tax production, because there are not a lot of other sources of revenue that are driving that sales tax level. Now, have any questions on this slide right there?
Yeah, I have a question on the property taxes. If we were to sort of exclude the pipeline, what would this percentage be in Alaska?
It would be fairly much. I think the best comparison I can give you, and if you bear with me for 1 second, I apologize. The challenge of doing this might not seem any advantage. I couldn't do this if I were directly in front of you. A way to think about this is just to think about where you are on homeowner occupied housing. And you are actually quite middle of the pack for housing itself. You have an effective rate on average of 0.98% on owner occupied housing. That's about the 21st nationwide, so very middle of the pack. You are basically taxing residential property very similar to others. I don't think commercial property, I don't have the number in front of me, I don't think it is dramatically different either. But what you're seeing, of course, is significant revenue generation from pipeline property and other oil and gas production property that just either is a non-factor or a small factor in other states.
Any other questions
for the 5% corporate income national state level quality number, can you please unpack that for us? I just want to contrast to 12% Alaska to a 5% national. Can you help me understand that better?
Thank you, sir. This is as a percentage of your state tax revenue, so of course you would rate the tax itself. You generate a little more revenue than a typical state would from corporate taxes. Part of it is that you do have, again, sometimes goes back to the oil and gas industry, that's just sort of inevitable here, that that's an industry that does pay more of the basins that were going to take that structurally making adjustments for net income. So, for instance, recently, the local engagement with tax income for Canadian Unicorns in US state scale. There are a number of structural things where you are a little less generous than other states. So, your corporate income tax is a little higher rate than the median. It is a little broader by its definition of taxable income than the median, not by enormous amounts, but a little more. But then again, the denominator is way lower. Your overall tax collections are so much smaller than other states that the overriding of the corporate income tax won't necessarily mean more. So just to clarify, if you want to take off the sales tax, your corporate income tax collections will drop significantly below 10%, not because you're less corporate income tax revenue, but because the denominator is down larger because you have additional sources of revenue.
And the 7% under property, including the back lines for Alaska, is that just running out of the state, or is that inclusive of money going to local governments? We have some jurisdictions that are seeing hundreds of millions of dollars each year for taxes based on a pipeline that's not out of the by the state. That has a 7% problem.
There's national guidelines of census data, which relies in turn on certifications from state and local governments. And to the best of my knowledge, the way that's reported the census and the way that it tested actually does account for that mistake only being it was a collector of that, and therefore it was in the local county. And that is my understanding of how census tables got in the distribution of census data.
Thank you.
And just for that committee's definition as well, that comparison here, looking at the revenue source and we look at property, including the pipeline on the left-hand columns are state only, or going over the two right-hand columns, those are looking at state and local combined. So that's where we look at that local decline property tax number referenced. We see our percentage of the property taxpayers in a tribal would include the local jurisdictions that are being referenced. Right. Any other questions? Okay, let's move on.
Okay, in a study that we put together about a year ago, we talked about three different ways that the state would need to respond to the revenue crisis. Of course, we didn't want to just be a pandemic, and therefore, just to anticipate that the federal government would be taking a fair amount of additional revenue. But we did look at the need for some reallocations, some reductions, and then potentially revenues. And we haven't already seen some of the reallocations. There's already been a reduction in the current fund. Dividends, there have been instances of almost there have been ways to address that. Obviously, there have also been depletions of a lot of funds, and you just run out of additional options there. I do, again, note that even analysis costs, fixed costs are just much higher per capita than always will be. Even in the same local combined, you are 50% higher than the average as of 2018, and you're actually higher than that now. We don't know the number of states, but it would be higher than that. It would probably be about 60% higher. I will circle back on that number. It's over twice the state level only, and I think it's 60-some% higher at the state level combined compared to the others.
Jump in here for a second to go to concern a little fun fact for context, and that is the size of the state of Alaska is so large that you could get the Nevada's in half and we would cut down with the state. So there are a couple of Texas inside of our state, so this is an important piece of context there for our friends in the world for these states.
And that's why I recognize that there have been reductions made, and there's no way to spend similarly to other states because of this. I was looking at the analysis for a couple of weeks ago, and my belief is that it would be, if you split the unorganized rural left from Alaska, the largest state would be the rest of Alaska, in conflict with each other. You can say a huge chunk of all these things adopted during the Great Depression. And Mississippi was the first in 1930 to have a legislation called the Mississippi Statute with minor alterations. And Mississippi adopted basically a driving tax. They were very good for basically a driving tax. And they expanded over time, but they don't really reflect 21st century economy and that piecemeal adjusted. So in Alaska, we're to adopt a sales tax. I think there's an opportunity to design one the way we do it in the 21st century rather than following all of these states that have done it before that have basically just adopted a 1930s model on what a sales tax looks like. And you know, there are questions about slide and take them, but if you want to, it's more just doing a chart graph. I'll show what I mean in the following slide on the changes in goods and services.
No questions.
So you can see that, historically, goods, the advertising and sales tax were, 50 to 60% of all of the personal consumption activities in the economy, and the services themselves were often services related to goods. And that has changed. Obviously, we're a much more service-oriented economy now. We have a lot of services firms, like personal services that we all consume, and it's gone from a point where it's hard to administer that to where it probably makes sense to include the personal services in the sales tax. So when we talk a little about what a sales tax would look like, I want to just say it makes sense to think about it at a broader base than a lot of your peers have. I think we may have some time limitations, so I'm going to jump back in if I can. I have a few questions, but I'll just get on that slide. And the next slide, this is an effort to look at our assumptions of how much you can raise under a number of scenarios. The Department of Revenue has also put together assumptions, and they're very slightly, and they're not trying to pitch our assumptions against theirs. But we believe actually these are similar methodologies, but the goal here is comparative analysis, so you can see what rates would generate different amounts of revenue based on different bases. So the broadest possible base, nobody has this. This is like your economist's ideal base. What if you put all personal consumption that involves the actual transaction in the base, and you could generate half a billion for 1.6% sales tax? Really efficient. But of course, this includes all medical services. Nobody does that. Kind of obviously, nobody does that. So we start there, and then we go down the list, like excluding one thing at a time. And the question is, where do you stop? And I would encourage you to take a think that you are going to do a sales tax. Now, think about a broad-based sales tax. Certainly, think about this because you have a corporate benefit. You have a sense of this negative income tax. Now, there are states that, because of the sales tax and fears about regressivity, would pick over $50 or $100 a year that households as essentially a rebate to regressivity, you have a $1,000 or $2,000 or whatever it may be in a given year in payment that's associated with individuals. So think about how you can structure this in a way that is relatively efficient, that is simple, that's neutral, that generates revenue from changes in the economy that you won't be able to anticipate now. Are you going to do some of these things at all? Certainly. But think about where you could go if you were doing this. So, you can see how quickly those rates rise as you start excluding more and more activities.
Thank you for the challenge, guys, on this list. Is this priority order in any way? Is there any trend in frequency of occurrence that can be gleaned from this? I mean, that part of it, you mentioned medical services, that's almost always the same time you said it, but can you speak to that?
Okay, for the chair, it is our effort to reflect some sense of the frequency with which they're accepted and the difficulty in taxing them. There's no way to perfectly objectively order this. So you might put it in a slightly different order, and we can help you figure out what the revenues would be associated with all those things. But now, roughly speaking, if you were to go look inside the matrix that the various types of insurance puts together, what things are taxed, or if you're looking at commerce theory and also like that, this would be about the same order in which these are taxed. Physician services a subset to perhaps slow down. The third is that everything on this list is except a pretty fair number of states.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. I understand things that just don't pass through for the Eastern Union. Your goods versus services graph, obviously, we're responding to services these days, but are there some things that just tax actual savings and buy and not, you know, going people who are having a dollar going to your house?
Many states begin by defining the sales tax base as tangible goods and then add select services. Every state includes some services. Most states do not include business-to-business transaction services, often professional services. So lawyers cannot be taxed, public services or public law may be taxed. Anything that is associated with both tangible property and a service is more likely to be taxed. So, for instance, installation is often taxed because it's associated with selling an appliance, for instance, or repairs on your car. You might tax repair service because you're also, in addition to that labor element, you're also, you've got parts and all of these other components. Those things are frequently taxed as services, or at least more frequently, whereas professional services tend to be less likely to be taxed, and pure business services that are sold to other businesses tend not to, not because you want to exclude businesses as a preference, but to avoid what's called tax purity, where the final transaction, the consumer actually buying a good or service, is going to only be taxed once. At that point, you shouldn't have intermediate transactions taxed along the way, where you tax, you know, the marketing and the packaging and the distribution and all of the other things within your sales tax along the way.
So, if I'm a contractor and I'm working on a lease on a house, and I go to Home Depot and buy $10,000 worth of lumber, I'm not going to tax that's business expenses. But then if I finish the job for the client, it's $50,000, that would be something that could be taxed because that's the consumer and it's material and services as well. But I mean, if you get a $50,000 vision to your platform or house or something, that's fully taxed and sales tax.
In the future, most states would tax you on materials, and a fair number would tax you on the actual labor services. That's probably 15 or 20 would do so. Yes. The assumption here is that the full value of any of these service sales or bids is subject to tax. And in most states, that's how the sales tax works with very small exceptions. A lot of states have cap on minimums, where maybe you only tax the first $25,000 worth of value. Otherwise, that's a little weird. I feel that people who are buying $80,000 cars probably start depending on sales tax than people who are buying $10,000 cars.
Same analysis on Thank you.
will never get that high, presumably, because you do have some revenue from other sources. And therefore, when you think about the percentage increase being delivered from each other, it will be significantly lower than what other states do with taking these significant sources of revenue. There are trade-offs, and the people that looks at the trade-offs associated with both of those. In a sales tax special opportunity, they do have 107 local sales taxes. And there have been a lot of efforts at trying to align them and coordinate post-write their decision so that municipal governments can collect remote sales tax. And I think that is a promising venture. It's had some success, but having the state administer that would be much more efficient, and it would mean that the local governments are able to collect far more than they do now than they would be able to just have. For compliance, I think we're going to use that opportunity to have unity and uniformity in those if they were doing all the sales tax. The challenge, of course, would be because local governments have gone low for all the time, but their own sales tax basis, they're different in different jurisdictions, and they also sometimes have higher rates, and trying to address that is very difficult. Most states have a uniform base. Other than Alaska, where it's locals only, it's really just Colorado, Louisiana, and to a very limited degree Alabama that don't have the same base all across the state. And all of those states have uniform collections as well. Registrations all have a so much opportunity there. Also, very much coordination challenge because the local governments have this authority to set their own rules. And if you go about the state tax, either it becomes very independent of the local sales taxes, and they're quite different from each other, or you have a difficult negotiation and discussion with local governments about how you coordinate things.
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. I think that we'll have an opportunity to talk with different departments in Alaska Municipal League about some efforts that they've been undertaking on this. I have a couple other questions. I mean, in looking at the tax burdens by state in which state had sales and income taxes, there's five states with one sales tax, and there's nine states with no income tax. And the only other state besides the state of Alaska, which has neither, is New Hampshire, flowed from them. And so the tax burden of states being 9.7% in New Hampshire, can you describe what the basis of that is?
Yes, thank you. New Hampshire has. Firstly, it has two different corporate taxes. It has essentially a traditional corporate income tax that's called the business enterprise tax, and then it has a value added tax as well. Again, the state has any form of value added tax. So they've got both of those. But more significantly, that's sort of the inverse that we discussed in Alaska, where government is very significantly devolved to the local level. They have very high property taxes, and local governments are almost exclusively responsible for a lot of services where the state is usually involved. They cover basically all of education, which they cover a significant portion of the road burden that you wouldn't see. You wouldn't see what most more states share in most other states or states being responsible for most of it. So you have high municipal taxes, and you have high corporate taxes. You have no individual income tax other than just a small tax on interest and dividends. And you have no sales tax. And it believes this burden is certainly lower than the national average, but it's not involved in the state level. It's never near as low as Alaska.
I think you said earlier this we adopted one of the bringing the sales or income tax, which we would certainly want to be the lowest compared to this year, not the density of the lowest, depending on how the structure is. It looks like the next one is the next one is 7%.
I'm sorry, yes, I believe that's correct. They have now the next lowest. I suspect that you might go past Tennessee, but not by a lot. You would be certainly in the bottom three if you adopted one of these taxes. Or really just not being discussed if you adopted both in some form. That would no longer be the case. They have a limited statewide property tax, which is more than most states, because most states don't have any statewide property taxes anymore. But the vast majority of property taxes.
just whether you did or not, you may have with some conversation that you've covered in this presentation, but it also seems to me that because we've gone 40-some years without a broad-based act, that whenever we have a fragmented taxation policy here, and that's targeting specific industries and other ones. And I'm just curious, do you have any experience that you can speak to of states that have gone from a fragmented or localized taxation system to implementing a broad-based tax? And is there a readjustment and recalibration that takes place, and giving advice for our state as we approach the possible decision to go down one of those routes?
Through the chair, there aren't a lot of examples of this situation simply because there are only United States about income tax. We have practices on sales tax. We've been in this position for a while now, and it's been incrementally increasing. We've seen states adopting this. What we haven't seen is a situation where neither of those are in place, and then one is adopted really since the Great Depression era. We've seen states where one of them wasn't in place. Connecticut, for instance, adopted an individual income tax in 1999 and had one before then. New Jersey adopted one around that time. But it was a sales tax before that. And in both cases, they're looking to reverse their revenue, but also looking to become high tax states. And that's what we're in Alaska. That's where we're going from having one tax system in the sort of traditional Canadian school, but also raising a lot of revenue from the others, and then using that additional money to high tax model that we were talking about. So it's a very different scenario. North Carolina is moderately interesting here as a state that shifted from heavy reliance on a couple of industries that were no longer quite as relevant to the economy and trying to have broader base taxes that were more neutral. But of course, that comparison only goes so far. North Carolina might have previously had a very textile and agriculture based economy to the tobacco and shifted away from that, but you can only stretch that comparison so far to look at the way that your taxes predominantly energy production is just so this comparison I can think of this meeting from the apologies. There's just not a lot like this. I do think diversification is important. It's important one, because it provides further stability, and two, because if you do have a secular decline in energy revenues, then if you're going to maintain the levels of spending that I think you want, and there's probably disagreements about what that level is, but everyone recognizes it's not about using stabilization, then you may need to look at other revenue sources, and I do think that sales tax is probably the more efficient way to go about, because it's also easier for state than it is to very geographically large, and that is sparsely populated to be rich because there are far fewer taxpayers. There are with an income tax. Honestly, at this point, don't have that much statewide experience with or capacity to even build it, but even interacting with everyone as a taxpayer.
Mr. Wilson, I just want to interrupt there for a second. With the sales tax, everyone in Alaska would still be a taxpayer. I think it's really important that we, be careful with our language, because whether it's an income tax or a sales tax, every Alaskan would be paying. And it's just that small businesses and large businesses across the state would also be involved in sort of formally, managing payment revenues of the sales taxes that they collected from individual Alaskans and tourists. So that's a very important distinction for me.
Madam Chair, I completely agree. I apologize for phrasing it that way. That was not my intent. I should not have made that mean to. Very much true. But everyone is a taxpayer in this. And we care a lot about the concept of economic incidents. And in this case, legal incidents, too. I mean, the individuals are responsible for their tax. In fact, if you use tax obligation, there's use tax things, too. What I intended to convey is that the number of points of contact with repairs of tax is far lower with the sales tax.
All right, absolutely.
Thank you for the chair. I understand Alaska is not the only state that analysis has been ongoing for that. It takes some constraints for trying to do the analysis. One of the things I think that was concerning, especially at the beginning of your presentation, is that you kind of seem to want to assume that the resources here in Alaska, natural resources were basically owned by industry, and here, of course, that's a separate distinction that Alaska has. But I think maybe the bigger distinction that I don't see in your analysis, which hopefully there's a way that you could maybe follow up on later, is the fact that most of our state revenue is coming from our partner fund, and I don't see much of your analysis breaking the last out in the other 49 states that would be presented as such a distinction. The vast majority of this campaign is our state revenue are not paid from these types of sources that are coming from investing in our partner fund.
Yeah, yes. And I think that that's the way the name was not intended. I was trying to emphasize what landfill industry meant about fair share of taxes or things like that, or who's going to pay with assets, but rather on landfill activity, the activity of energy and resource extraction being an outsized element, because this is important for understanding how burns are stored, and it's also important for understanding volatility of the tax code. It is not intended as a comment on the ultimate ownership, of course, in the residents of Alaska, or the ultimate owners of that resource. And I don't think that affects the purpose analysis, but I'm confident that it affects the purpose analysis. It would be, I think, misleading to go the other way and suggest that Alaskans have like a 40% effective tax rate, which is probably what you end up getting. That's just not what it is. Resources that are common to Alaskans. And I apologize if I'm missing something else here.
I was just pointing out that a lot of the analysis I see is really assuming that we're more like other states, whereas the distinction that I think is maybe most important is that our current revenues in the state are kind of the majority of those from investment income and not these other types of sources.
I mean, that's absolutely the case. I think some of the early slides did highlight the, I think there were two or three solid investment income on the charts, and the paper that goes into that in much more detail. It's fairly unusual. Every state has a line item for investment income, but there's usually not a lot of assets that are held invested outside of pension funds. So you're in a very unique situation here. Now, some of that is a decline because there have been trials against it, but you still have an enormous permanent fund that just doesn't have anything comparable to it in any other state. Wyoming has, by the results, about 100% of general fund revenue, so they've got 1 year general fund in reserve. Like, you have the investment return on that, the closest you can see, you have nothing like the set aside still has to have with the current fund and the future budget reserve. And the other funds that can generate investment income. And it's certainly true. It's something that we can try to reflect in the power analysis that we would be happy to send all of you. The volatility assessment of that, of course, though, as in the Great Recession, we had negative investment returns. And as Mr. Frost makes note, that was a very personal fraction of their overall revenue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Comment about being careful about how the terms we need to describe things. I mean, you're just saying that Alaska's permanent fund ultimately belongs to the people. And I think that's important to keep in mind, because I agree that it belongs to people, doesn't belong to politicians. And what that fundamentally does is take the decision away from the individual and put it into the collective and some of the terms that were supposedly representing people. We were taking money, even the permanent fund, and certainly the royalty part of the resources, we're taking that from Alaskans, we're taxing that. It's appropriate, it's not a voluntary transaction, and we need to keep that in mind as we evaluate this, because I know a number of Alaskans think that the resource for the permanent fund belongs to them and not in fact to the politicians like us. It just makes Alaska unique. I think it's difficult to compare any state to another because we're all in but I don't know that it's profitable for us to compare and think that we should have a sales tax just because somebody else does or we get a charge or we lose a chance of that. And then ultimately what we have to look at is the in-migration versus out-migration, because people ultimately end up with their feet. And it appears in the last several years that people are going to leave the state, and we need to be careful of that.
So, we're seeing lots of people who are the comments, and one of the things that we heard earlier on the presentation from the Department of Labor about the fact that we've seen 35,000 more people leave the state than enter the state over the last 80 years, was that economic stability was one of the drivers that Alaska has always had high population turnover. In fact, many of y'all are in this room, they're from somewhere else. And those had high population churn. What's happened recently is the same number of people are roughly leaving the state as a percentage of our population every year, but fewer people are coming here because they have the opportunity. It's complicated. Yeah, and I think that one of the things that comes from a lot of these presentations left to me, sometimes folks say that if we were talking about gravity research, people would leave the state of Alaska, and I would say, is where do they have to go? Where they wouldn't have, you know, revenue, you know, they wouldn't have some responsibility to pay some sort of a sales or income tax somewhere else. And another way of looking at a tax is that it's a way that we all sort of get in together as a family, as an Alaskan family, to take care of things that are important to us, like public safety and education, like making sure that our rooms are plowed. And given that we've had structural deficits now for, you know, the last 7 years, you know, that Mr. Wilson describes, you know, an important point that you need to have income diversity, so that if market tanks for a couple of years, well, in a permanent fund value, we'll actually be able to have earnings revenue. Oil prices go for a bigger down again, there would be some balance to that as well, and I think it's an insightful point. So, thank you very much for your presentation today. It was interesting, I think, related to some things. The next meeting with us, we're going to be meeting today with you on Tuesday, April 20th. I will be bringing it out here in Davis from 106. I intend to bring back before the committee at HB 165, the tax class on from Corbett, from the Earth Reserve of Corbett, and HJR Web Credit and Constitution as a PLMB. Under once, either one of these pieces of legislation need to be submitted to Rose Holman and Travis Wetland during the AIM on Monday, April 19th, and seeing no further business before the committee today.